Welcome to Inflammation Nation. My name is Brian Lynch. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. I'm delighted to be joined by Áine O'Hara, an award-winning performance artist, theatre maker and facilitator who is based between Dublin and Mayo. Áine creates exciting and vulnerable work for and about people who are often left out of traditional art and theatre spaces. Áine, great to have you here.
Great to be here.
I'm intrigued by your work as an artist in using chronic illness and disability as a source of inspiration. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I suppose. I have fibromyalgia and also endometriosis and a couple of different mental health conditions too, a fun pile. And as long as I can remember, I've used art to kind of work through feelings or frustrations or find humor in things. So when I sort of developed chronic illness, it was natural for me to kind of turn to art to work through it and also to connect with other people who might have experienced similar things to me. So I suppose I started making work initially about my experiences trying to find a diagnosis and trying to engage with medical professionals, I suppose, and kind of how I was ignored and repeatedly misdiagnosed. And I wanted to survive that time. Like, it was a very difficult time mentally as well as physically. And I suppose art was really helpful to me in working through those things and in connecting with others that have experienced similar stuff, I suppose.
Mm. So you weren't even thinking so much of an external audience. This was very much you as a creative person looking to find a way of dealing with what's going on in your body and your life.
Yeah, I mean, at the time when I was starting to make those kind of works, I was initially doing like drawings and some writing. And I really didn't think that many people would ever see it because I was sort of at a point in my career where I was really physically unable to go anywhere or do anything. So I was like, well, any kind of progress I've made in my career as an artist is probably done. You know, I was like, look, this is probably it. I can't do the long hours. I can't stand up. Like, I'm just going to do this for myself because this is my natural way of dealing with like struggle is to create. So I really didn't think that anyone was ever going to see the works that I was making or the kind of ideas that I was working with.
And did that impact then in turn the fact that you were free from, if you like, maybe the pressure of an external audience or looking for acclaim or any of the normal things maybe that somewhere is at the back of an artist's mind, that you could just simply do this for yourself in response to where and how you were?
Yeah, for sure. Like, there's a big freedom in that, especially when you're, like, now when I'm making work, I'm much more aware of like, what if my doctor was to see this? Would that impact how they speak to me, how they see me, how they treat me? Whereas at the time I was like, okay, I'm gonna draw a cartoon about like this ridiculous thing a doctor said to me today. And I'd never thought they would see it. And so I didn't think that it would impact me in any way. And it did give me kind of a freedom to do whatever I wanted in a way that I didn't have before while creating artworks that were like true to life, I suppose. Mm.
Did you find then, looking back, is there a dark humor through some of it? How would you describe the emotional resonance of the work?
Yeah, for sure. Like throughout my career, I suppose that's like a constant. It's a part of my personality as well. And I think it's present for a lot of us with chronic illnesses or disabilities because you're like fighting against this world that's like not built for you. And in order to keep going, you sort of have to sometimes laugh about things that are really, really horrible and difficult, because otherwise you would be overwhelmed by like the pressure and just give up, I suppose. So yeah, there's a huge element of dark humor in all of my work, even if it's not about chronic illness. It's just part of who I am as a person, and also a very Irish thing, I think, to just sort of make fun of yourself and make fun of horrible situations.
Mm. And what way then, when you got the fibro diagnosis, you were diagnosed that fibromyalgia was in 2016?
Yeah, I think it was 2016. So it, on the one hand, it was like, it was a relief to hear someone finally listen to what I was saying and immediately believe me and immediately give it a name. There's like a lot of talk about whether or not having a name for what's wrong is really helpful, especially in something like fibro, where they're not really gonna, there isn't a, they can't say, oh, we're gonna fix you now, done. But I found it really, really helpful to have that diagnosis and purely to be believed, because at that point I was like, I was questioning myself and I was questioning what was going on with my body and if I was, if it was true, you know, like doing all the second guessing.
And had it taken you quite a while to get a diagnosis then? What was that like?
Yeah, it took me years. Like, I saw lots and lots of doctors. Because I have a history of mental illness from when I was a child, like I have an anxiety disorder. So initially it was kind of put on that. So people were like, well, you have an anxiety disorder, you have depression. So it's probably this. And I was kind of, because of the way our health service works, it was easier to give me medication straight away because they couldn't give me access to therapy or counseling straight away unless I was like at a breaking point, which is obviously a really big problem. So I was kind of put on lots and lots of different medications that really were really difficult, and I found the experience of being on them horrible and really confusing, and this kind of kept going on for maybe 4 years, where I was sort of trying different doctors, trying different antidepressants, anti-anxieties, and nothing was working and nothing was changing. And I remember I like sat down and I was like, I have to get out of this, like this cycle isn't working and I don't know what to do anymore. And I like wrote out a script for my doctor and I wrote down everything that was happening, and I was like trying to psych myself up, and I went in and I was like, okay, we need to sort this out. And I was like, make eye contact, you know, like just sit the right way, like be assertive. And she like really took me seriously, and she could kind of see it in me that I was just done, and I needed help. And the problem is that like I had to say, refer me to a rheumatologist, refer me to a neurologist, refer me to, like I had to almost tell her what to do, and she did, but I did have to pay for it because the waiting list is so long. But when I finally did get to that rheumatologist, that's when I got the diagnosis, and that's when I sort of felt like I was getting some power back, because I felt like, oh, I'm not imagining this. Finally, someone has said, yeah, oh yeah, you have this. You're not imagining it. It's real. No, we can't cure it, but here are some things that we can do. Like it felt like there was finally, I could finally take some action that might be actually helpful in a way that trying all of these meds that weren't necessarily helpful to fibro was.
I'm wondering, is that external validation by an expert, by a healthcare professional, what does that do to you in terms of how you feel about yourself then, your own internal validation? Does it impact it in any way? Do you kind of feel to yourself, oh yeah, I'm not actually imagining all of this. This is kind of, they have told me that this is what it is. It's kind of diagnosed now. How did it affect you?
I was really upset. I was really mad. Like I was like grateful that this was finally happening, and I was happy that it was something, we had a name for something. But I was really mad and really upset, and it really impacted my mental health, because I was like, okay, so it's been like 4 years, so I could have been working on this 4 years ago. I didn't have to go through all of that stuff that I went through. Like I didn't have to if this had happened sooner. So I spent like some time being really, really angry about it, I suppose.
And did your creative work, did it help with processing of that? Was that filtering through in terms of what you were doing, what you were producing?
Yeah, actually, after I was diagnosed, there was like a period of time where I really didn't want to make anything. I think I was just sick of everything and I didn't feel like the work could say much. I didn't feel like I had much to say. It was like a really low point. And then, funnily enough, I started chasing another diagnosis, like 2 years later, for like chronic pelvic pain. Mm. And during that, I started making similar work again. And I started, I suppose I use it kind of like to encourage me. Like I kind of use the work as like a little cheerleader on the sidelines going like, you can do it, keep going, it's fine. It's true.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of describing it, chasing a diagnosis. Did it feel like that?
That's exactly what it is. Like, that's it. Literally a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, I finally got diagnosed also with endometriosis. And that issue has been going on since I was 12. Like, the symptoms of that disease have been going on since I was 12. And fighting to get the fibro diagnosis taught me that I do know what I'm talking about in terms of my own body. I'm not imagining things. I do have the power. So when these symptoms like started getting much, much more severe, I was like, I need to do something about this, and I can. But I knew it was a fight. Like, it is a fight. I mean, to get diagnosed with endometriosis takes people 9, 10 years plus. It took me 18 years. So I don't know how else to describe that other than chasing.
Yeah.
And I think that, especially in terms of conditions that involve pain or pelvic conditions, for women or people who have uteruses, these conditions are kind of like pushed aside, overlooked, ignored. You're kind of told that period pain is normal. And you're like, yeah, but to what extent? Like, how much pain is normal? And it involves such a huge slog to finally convince someone that you're not talking about some cramps. You're talking about like passing out from the pain. Like, it's like, it's very serious.
A whole other order, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And we have so little vocabulary to describe pain in a clear way to medical professionals, that I'm in pain sounds, you know, that could mean 100 things. And it's really difficult to communicate pain, especially when you're someone that lives with chronic pain and are used to almost like masking the pain, or like, because it takes energy to perform pain. So after years of chronic pain, you learn to be like, I'm sitting here and I'm still, my face is not winced, I'm not crying, but I'm in a ton of pain. And you learn to do that. And I suppose that, like, as far as I know, in medical school, like, the small amount that you talk about, say, chronic pain, if I was to go into A&E, what those medical professionals are looking for is, like, if I say, oh, I'm going to pass out, I'm like 5 minutes from passing out, they're like, why aren't you crying? Why aren't you bent over? Why is your face relaxed? This person is looking for drugs. Like,
And is that what you mean by that expression, to perform pain?
Yeah, I think it's because of like my background in theater and stuff, I kind of think of it all as like an elaborate performance.
Yeah.
And I think of often going to the doctor as like a performance, and I have my script and I have to act a certain way and talk a certain way because that's how you get results. And it's very grim. And I don't mean this for everyone. Like, there are some people that are very sound and you can be upfront with them and they understand these things. But you can't understand every condition. Like, there isn't enough time for like a GP to know everything about every condition. So I do think that they need to be taught a lot more about pain and about how people act when they're in pain long term. Because I almost sometimes when I'm like trying to talk to or trying to get assistance, like say when I was looking for that endometriosis diagnosis, I sometimes think that if I went in and I was crying and I was bent over, I would be taken more seriously. And I want to find the words to explain that, like, I've learned not to do that because I wouldn't be able to continue if I was like bent over in pain all of the time. And obviously there are points, there's like a level of pain that I can't, I suppose, ignore, and that I do lose control. But yeah, I suppose I find it really interesting how people with chronic pain eventually learn to like look like they're not in pain.
I'm interested then in terms of extending that beyond, say, healthcare professionals, who are obviously crucial. Their understanding of what you're going through is absolutely essential. But in terms of, you know, your engagement with them, it probably, for a lot of people, you know, who are living with conditions, it'll be, you know, relatively infrequent in the scheme of things. Most part, we're dealing with family, friends, relations, work colleagues, the neighbours.
How does
that extend then, this kind of, I don't want to say role playing, because that's an unfair way of describing it. Because again, you're probably putting on your best sense there. You have to really, to get through life, you know, for yourself as much as for anyone else. But does that cause challenges on you in terms of how people understand you are as living with chronic pain and in chronic pain? Because they just see you looking fine and healthy and going about your life in an ordinary, productive fashion.
Yeah, I think so. And especially in terms of like art or like, say, my social media, do you know, I post about things when I'm doing a show, when I have an artwork that I want to talk about. And sometimes I worry that other people, or say other artists, especially other artists with chronic illnesses, look at that and go, why am I not doing this? They look so like, they look like they're doing lots of stuff. They look like they're never sick. And you sort of wonder like how much you should talk about the sort of truth behind it and like what you're experiencing sort of privately. It's very difficult. I mean, it's difficult with like family and friends as well. Although the people that know me the best can see like just in my eyes when pain is like stronger than usual, which is also interesting about like knowing a person so well that you can literally see the pain in their eyes is cool.
One of the things that kind of strikes me about your work is that you use it as a mechanism to engage with other people. And you talk about excluded groups, you know, people with ill health or disability that are, you regard as being, and oftentimes are, in fact, excluded from, say, theatre, from art spaces. But last year and, you know, ongoingly, you have used the arts as a way of bringing people together through chronic chats and other initiatives you've undertaken. What was that like as a leader, as a facilitator, maybe as a curator, perhaps? What was it like kind of bringing other people together with that commonality of experience?
It was great. Like, I often feel like left out in, especially in theatre. It can be very difficult to be someone that works behind the scenes and also like need accommodations, because the industry is so underfunded. Until you get to like the absolute top level, that you're expected to work, you know, 14 hour days, work through breaks. You know, no one's forcing you to do this, but the expectation is there for everyone. And it's really hard to continue to do that and also to advocate for yourself and say, look, I have to take an hour break. When you're trying to continue to get work and you're trying to stay in the industry and you still want people to listen to you. So I suppose doing something like Chronic Chats, which was sort of a peer support group where we kind of met up and like chatted and also created, did some drawings. We did some colouring based on some drawings that I had already done. And we just kind of talked about our experiences, and being around other creative people that had similar experiences just made me feel way less alone. In a way that I wasn't necessarily expecting. Like, I really wanted to bring people together and I wanted to give people a space where they could be creative from home, like from their beds or whatever was comfortable for them. But I wasn't expecting for it to be so, I don't know, unbelievably like powerful for me as well. Like it was just amazing to like feel like I wasn't the only one. I mean, I know I'm not the only one,
mm-hmm.
but I often feel very alone in being sick and working in the arts, because it's often such a solitary role, I suppose, and you don't want to be, you have to fight a lot already to be an artist, that you're trying, well, I was trying sort of, say 2 years ago, not so much anymore, I was trying to like almost hide my illnesses, my disabilities, because I wanted to keep getting work and I didn't want it to impact my career, and I was like putting too much pressure on myself. But to finally like be in like a virtual room with other people that had similar experiences was really great. And I really enjoyed working on that project with them.
Mm. It strikes me though that, you know, for a lot of people, particularly when they leave school, maybe primary school, the idea of, unless they're, you know, intrinsically creative and arty, we'll say that, the idea of colouring or drawing probably is not something that, you know, crops up in their life hugely often. And I know we, you know, there is the vibe and the move towards adult colouring books and part of mindfulness, you know, which has been, you know, such a huge trend and so beneficial for so many. But did people find it strange if they were not in that space ordinarily and now they were kind of being encouraged to kind of express themselves artistically and think about that? Were there barriers that people had to kind of overcome to get into that mind space and just be comfortable with doing that?
Yeah, I think there definitely was, like you were saying, sort of colouring especially is like seen as kind of a thing that a child does. But I suppose that kind of like resurgence of colouring books that happened a few years ago helped, because people were like, oh no, this is to do with like your mental health. So that definitely helped kind of spur it along. And also I found again that using that dark humor, like these drawings were kind of the comics that I was talking about that are almost making fun of myself, making fun of my situation and kind of looking at the absurdity of trying to get a diagnosis for something, which many of these people had experienced. That broke the ice. So like people initially were like, oh, colouring. And then they saw the drawings and they were like, ah, this is gas. I have experienced this too. And kind of that sort of like was a door into the workshops or the process for them.
Anya, I said earlier in terms of using ill health, if you like, as a source of inspiration for your work. But it also strikes me that some of your work is kind of political, if you like, with a small p, in terms of its campaigning, its work as advocacy, where you're looking to kind of change people's attitudes or increase awareness around what it's like being a person with ill health, with chronic pain, with a chronic condition, and to represent what it's like being an individual in that context, dealing with the state or dealing with health services. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your work in that and what that's been like as an artist?
Yeah, I suppose I kind of fell into this as like often many disabled people do, of like just wanting to live our lives in a normal way becomes political, because there are so many barriers against us into like just getting places, just doing really, really normal things. And I wanted to use my work to draw attention to that, with like specifically in regards to the arts. So at the moment I have a piece called Personal Ads to the Art World, which is on a billboard outside Project Arts Centre in Temple Bar. And it's kind of written in the format of like a personal ad, like those romantic personal ads from the past. And it's me kind of exposing a little bit about myself. So I suppose the title reads, We're Wrecked, because I'm wrecked. I'm tired, and we're all really tired of repeatedly like having to fight for ourselves, for our like human rights, for our like basic needs. And it invites Irish art venues to have a conversation with me, a paid conversation, to pay me to talk to them about access in their venue. And I mean that in like a really broad term. I'm not talking about like just having a ramp, I think, which unfortunately became like just the one thing associated with access for really long time. And the expectations on buildings and venues have been very low for a really long time. And a lot of things are sort of like let fly if a building is like protected or because there's nowhere else we could rent because Dublin is the renting hellhole. And things are kind of let slide. So I suppose I'm sort of offering up just a casual chat with myself to art centres to see where they are, to see if I can help them in any way change how they interact with audiences in general, because often these access like things can help everyone. Like you know, having daytime shows helps me because I don't want to be up at night because it hurts more. But it would also help people who are parents or carers or people, you know, like there's lots of different people that things like that would help. So I'm hoping to talk to some different venues throughout September as part of that project.
And what has been the response so far, or is it still too early to say?
We've had a pretty good response. A good few sort of directors and like building managers have got in touch with me and are going to chat to me in September. So I'm really excited about that. People seem open to the idea. And I think, not to bring up the dreaded pandemic, but the last like year and a half actually has made people reassess their own access needs, whether they're chronically ill or disabled or not, and sort of reassess work and overwork and the pressures that we put on ourselves. And I think that people are much more open to having conversations like that now. And I'm really excited to, I suppose, continue talking, because I think that we just need to be open about it. We can't be afraid to ask about access. We can't be afraid to talk about disability or chronic illness, because that's where all of the problems stem from, is like our shame. You're sort of worried that you've made mistakes, so you don't want to bring it up, and then no one ever talks about it and nothing ever changes.
It's resolved at all.
So I think we just need to be more open, I suppose, about it.
It's really interesting there how you kind of frame, you know, access or ability / disability within, I suppose, the physical buildings, if you like, in terms of, you know, wheelchair ramps, for example. But yet we often think of the arts as being, you know, so finely attuned to representing the other and marginalized voices. But yet we know it doesn't always work out. You know, theatre and representation of women there and their participation has been obviously a hot issue. And it kind of brings us to this idea, if you like, of invisible disability and that expectation that, you know, that disability almost that if you're not the placard holding or it should be immediately obvious. So how does the arts, how do you think the art world can engage with that or deal with it, either in terms of the creative process or accessibility?
I mean, I think that we need to be much more open about things like that from the beginning. I think if you're, say you're in charge of a project or you're a producer, say in theatre, and you're working with a team, I think having discussions about access, having discussions about like needs in general at the beginning of a project is really important for everyone and makes everyone's lives better. Like, I'm currently working with a company who have created like this sort of amazing like form. It's really short. It kind of says like, do you have access needs? And then it kind of gives a couple of suggestions. So like, do you need larger print text? Would taxis to and from rehearsals be helpful for you? Are there any times that you don't want to have meetings? Like, are weekends out of it? You know, I think giving a couple of suggestions kind of maybe makes people feel like they can actually ask for things. I think it's really important as well at the start of whether it's like a production meeting talking about a play that's going to go on or talking about like a visual art show, to talk about what happens if one of us can't continue for some reason. So like, if an actor can't continue and it's the week of the show, what happens? Do we put pressure on someone who's sick to continue? Do we have a backup plan? Like, I think it's really important to have lots of contingency plans for things like that, because often the worst work practices happen in that week of the show, where the show becomes the most important thing. And like, we're all guilty of that as artists, and it's kind of been put on us by like the sort of chronic lack of funding forever of the arts, that we have to power through and we have to work harder than everyone else because we won't get another chance. There's no more money. This is it. If we mess this up, it's over. But we need to have contingency plans to look at in those like crucial moments. We need to have a welfare person in those moments that you can go to and say, I'm really sick and I can't go on. And they go, okay, that's fine. We won't hate you. We won't like tell all companies never to work with you again. We will accept that that's a part of life and we will figure it out. And obviously more funding from the Arts Council would help there a lot, because obviously if you have more money, you have more freedom to replace people, rebook venues, whatever. But we just need to, I suppose, sometimes let go of the show must go on sort of thing, because, you know, not at all costs. It's more important than like someone's well-being.
Yeah.
It's just not.
Yeah. It's an interesting reevaluation of priorities. In my introduction to you earlier, I described you as an artist and a theatre maker. And it strikes me that some of the projects that you have led, like, say, for example, The Patient Will See You Now, which ran last autumn in the A4 Sound Gallery, which looked at, brought other people in to the process, like, you know, and focused on changes in accessing the health system in Ireland. Can you tell us a little bit about that, maybe where the idea originated and describe it and what you were hoping to achieve there?
Yeah, so I suppose this work, which was like a large scale installation that you kind of came, experienced. There was physical artwork like drawings and kind of signs. And there were some sculptural pieces in terms of chairs that you sat on. And then at the end of the sort of experience, you had a meeting with me, sort of as a doctor slash patient, like an expert patient, if you will, because a lot of the time people with endometriosis are described as expert patients because we know so much about the condition. We know. So that work stemmed from those drawings that I was talking about creating when I was trying to figure out what was wrong when I was looking for that fibromyalgia diagnosis. So I was really lucky to get this residency with A4 Sounds. They really focus on giving people who don't often get access to things like a solo show, a big space to themselves, a studio, support. And also they're really supportive in terms of like helping you cover your rent, help, you know, knowing that you need to eat. They're really aware of like practical things you need. And it was a really new way of working for me and kind of gave me the freedom to really experiment and really go big with this piece. So I suppose I wanted to reevaluate medical spaces in Ireland and the process of finding a diagnosis in Ireland. And I wanted to offer some comfort to people that had been through that process and also shed some light on it for people who maybe had only ever been in the hospital to like visit their granny when she was sick or something, you know, like once. So I suppose I was trying to do two things. And there were two different experiences to be had. I kind of offered one experience if you were identifying as chronically ill or disabled, and I offered another experience if you were not. And it ended with sort of a part scripted conversation with me in which we talked about like utopias, like what would be the ideal health system? Like, is it possible to have an ideal healthcare system when living under capitalism? And I kind of invited participants to give me their unfiltered opinions, like tell me what you think like the Minister for Health should do, or go even bigger and just be like, so if we started again, when we finally had power over our own country, part of it, what could we have done differently? Was it possible? And we had lots and lots of really interesting conversations. And there was a few like med students and medical professionals that came, and it was really interesting to get their point of view, because obviously they know so much more about the system and have been also mistreated chronically by the system as well. So yeah, it felt really productive to have those conversations, and I'm really hoping to kind of move forward with that research, to kind of continue creating work around this idea of healthcare utopias and like the ideal system. Like, what do I actually want from going to see the doctor?
I know we're obviously, this is an audio medium, and so it might be a bit challenging, but you described there was two pathways. So some, you know, for people who identify themselves as living with chronic illness, and then say for others. Can you describe what they were seeing? What were they experiencing as they worked their way through the exhibition?
I suppose that one of the main like sculptural pieces of the work was a bench, kind of a row of chairs, and they were bright orange, and there were two. So there was one that was just a normal row of orange chairs, and there was one that was at an angle. So one of the chairs was much, much higher, and one of the chairs was on ground level. What I was trying to do with that particular sculpture was get across the uneasiness on my feet that fibro gives me. So it's almost like you're constantly about to fall over. Like it's always like you're going to fall, you're going to fall, your knee's going to go now any minute. And I was trying to get across how I feel physically in my body when I'm sitting in those waiting areas. And kind of, because at the time that I was kind of thinking about this work, creating this work, I was spending so much of my time like sitting in hospital waiting rooms for hours, thinking about like how they could be designed better, thinking about how to get across this like physical pain that the specific room was kind of giving me. And I wanted to find a way to get people to like step into my body for a second and experience the physical feeling that I was feeling. And then there was kind of an easier path where you sat on a chair for like a minute, and then I called you in straight away. You didn't wait. If you're chronically ill or disabled, you do not have to wait to talk to me. Come on in. So those were kind of the two routes. Mm-hmm. It was either waiting for a really long time and trying to give people a real perspective on the kind of stuff that we experience like weekly, or changing that for people that do have to experience it all the time. Mm.
And was this the exhibition where you displayed some of your drawings almost as if they were x-rays?
Yes. So the drawings that I did, those drawings that I've been speaking about, we kind of hung them up on a rail, and you were invited to go and look at them after you had spoken to me. I was really trying to like make like an absurd, I was trying to bring the sort of dark humor even into the way that I displayed the items, because these drawings for me are like my medical history for that time, because I was getting all these tests and everything was, you know, great, fine, you're so healthy, and I was like, I'm obviously not. So these drawings are my medical records, and I was trying to get that across by displaying them in that way, I suppose.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it comes back to, you know, conditions for which it's difficult to get a diagnosis, or you can't point to something, you know, on a scan or an x-ray or a blood test. And it's almost kind of your word kind of trying to be, it is the evidence, you know.
Yeah.
And I love that idea that the drawing itself took on that credibility, that that veracity, if you like, that here it is, here's the proof, like, you know.
Yeah, what, see, I told you.
What was that like for you as the creator of that? That must have been really empowering, I imagine.
It was. Because at the time I didn't realize that I would be looking back at these drawings going like, you were right, it's okay, mm-hmm. like you made it through. It was really fun, and I suppose to get to show them off to everyone now that I've gone through it. I think it would have been much different, obviously, if I didn't have a diagnosis and I was showing these, I think it would have had a, it would have said something much different.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah, where they were almost after the facts that here you have them, like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I still look back at them to try and figure out, oh, what was going on then? How was I feeling then? How much, you know, to try and like, when I'm, I suppose, figuring out my day to day, like, am I worse? Am I better? Has something changed? I do go back to them the same way that you would go back to like an MRI report or like a, some blood tests. And I find that really interesting as a thing, that they're both an artwork and also like literally a medical record for myself.
Sure, sure. Anya, if anyone is interested in finding out more about your work, where can they see your stuff?
Well, if you're in Dublin, you can walk down to Temple Bar, or I'm really sorry if you're in a wheelchair and you want to go to Temple Bar because it's hell. You can also see my work on my website, anyaohara.com. I'm on Instagram at misc.aine. I'm also on Twitter, but I don't really post about art. I just kind of go on about the gas. So if you want to see that, you can.
Yes, as a proud Mayo person, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, the GEA it's inevitably going to be a hot topic.
Yeah, there. I can never stop talking about it.
Fantastic. Listen, it has been such a pleasure meeting you and having this conversation. I've really, really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for sharing your time, your story and your personal experience. I know our listeners would certainly enjoy it as well. That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Stitcher, or as they always say, wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about arthritis, you can visit our website, arthritisireland.ie, or contact our helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.